Case number 13-5250, Harold H. Hodge versus Pamela Talkin, Marshal of the United States Supreme Court et al. Appellants. Ms. Brinkman for the appellants, Mr. Light for the appellee.
Morning. May it please the court, Beth Brinkman on behalf of the appellants. With me at council table are Michael Rabb and Daniel Tenney from the Department of Justice. Mr. Hodge, the plaintiff here, is able to demonstrate and picket with his placard on the sidewalk in front of the Supreme Court. At the same time, the provision at issue here directs that conduct to the sidewalk rather than to the Supreme Court Plaza.
Is there anything in the record indicating the size of the sidewalk?
There is a diagram, Your Honor, that is
it scale?
I believe it is to scale. Yes, I can confirm that if need be, but yes, I believe it's to scale, and it demonstrates that the sidewalk is very wide, and if you look at it, you can see why. There are two features that are different than the sidewalk on each side. Beyond where the stairways up to the court start for the plaza. On the other sidewalks, there's room between the curb and the sidewalk, which is a grassy area. There is no grassy area directly in front of the Supreme Court steps. That's part of the sidewalk there also. In addition, as the sidewalk comes across the front of the court, it cuts in to where the steps start up to the plaza and up to the court. And the demonstrations are allowed all the way up to the bottom of that step. So it is a very, very deep sidewalk. And
so if you demonstrations are allowed
all the way up to the bottom of
that. To the bottom of the step.
Yes, exactly. That's all considered part of the sidewalk. And I would just also point out one fact, not to be confusing. There are bollards, I believe, the little poles, security poles at the front that are an archway, but the protesters come past that. That is not the line at which the public sidewalk starts. It comes all the way up to that bottom step. And that explains, I think, part of the function and the purpose and the history that demonstrate that it's not a public forum. These steps are the beginning of the pathway up to the court, up to the courtroom itself. Cass Gilbert designed this from the inception as part of the building's structure and raised it at a level above the sidewalk at a terrace level. Also, the area is enclosed by a marble railing. It is the same marble railing that goes around the entire base of the Supreme Court. It has the same motif as the actual railing in the courtroom itself, although made of a different material. This is all marble. And it serves this purpose of a transition to the building. It's part of that structure, and it's transitioning to the solemnity of that. It also is not a public forum because part of the function and the purpose that it serves is a type of antechamber, the first approach to the pathway up to the court. The stairway begins there, then there's this plaza terrace level, and it's there that the interest and security and protection of the courthouse are important. The demonstrators cannot be at the doorway to the courthouse. We know that there's immediate security they have to go through. So there has to be some area in order to establish the order and decorum to prepare for that entryway. And the record indicates that on times there are 50,000 people involved in demonstrations approaching the Supreme Court.
So the way you argue the case, I think there's two components to the statute. One is the assemblage part and one is the display part. As I understand your argument, you think we shouldn't consider the assemblage part at all because you think there's a lack of standing.
We do, Your Honor. We think the complaint is written in a way that is very speculative and suggests perhaps the possibility of there perhaps being like-minded individuals. What the core of the complaint goes to is Mr. Hodge wanting to reenact, take again the same action he took before of picketing individually in violation of this.
Okay, so we could talk about that for a second, of whether the allegations are sufficient for standing on the assemblage part, but in terms of what's at issue in the case, if we accept your understanding of what we should be focusing on, the assemblage part is out of the case, all we're talking about is the display part, then as to the display part, a lot of what you've talked about is the gathering of people in the plaza area and how it's a threshold entryway into the next step, which is the steps to go up into the court building. But as to one of the justifications that's been provided for this is ingress and egress. If we take out of the field of vision assemblage and we're only talking about display, then it does seem like the ingress-egress objective is not as much in play.
I think that the major interests that are served here really are more of the order and decorum of the court that is served, and also the protection, the security, the preparation for entering in the solemn manner, and this is part of that structure.
What's the difference between these two? So I was a little confused as to, it seemed like there was three justifications that were bandied about, and it comes from grace. So there's ingress and egress, and we could put that to one side for the reasons that you just suggested. And then there's decorum. And then there's this notion that there shouldn't either be the reality or the perception that the court is subject to sway, the Supreme Court is subject to sway based on what's described as external influences. What's the difference between decorum and the last one? Are they getting at the same thing, or is there actually a distinct?
I think there is a distinct, Your Honor. I think the order and decorum, it's really throughout the statute, it's what the marshal is charged with maintaining at the court. So it is the order of public safety, ensuring people who aren't supposed to go into the building don't get in, firearms, things like that can't be. That's all at the very entryway in the security. And so the plaza that's part of the building, it's very distinct from the public sidewalks. It's starting there. So even without the assemblage part, the display provision goes to conduct that has the manifestations to attract onlookers and a crowd. So even if you're not talking about the assemblage provision, I don't want to put the idea of people gathering aside from the display clause, because that is what our understanding, if you look at the text of the statute, it does talk about something, not just something that's visible, something that's displayed, not just a flag, banner, or a device, but something that is intended to attract public notice. And I think in the Oberwetter case, for example, at the Jefferson Memorial, the court talked about that interest in ensuring that the government property, that non-public forum, is not used for that kind of effort to attract onlookers and a crowd. So I don't think that issue is eliminated by simply focusing on the display.
So it's about crowd control. It's not this idea that when you display a sign, there's the perception, there's either the reality and or the perception that the court is subject to influence outside the normal channels of briefing and argument.
I do think that's
another that's in the case, and you've relied on that about heavily.
But you're form order, because we say it so quickly. I don't want to just throw it away. Order is about security. Decorum is about also the solemnity. That's why the plaza is so different from the public sidewalk, and there is a visual distinction, and it is the way in which the visitors prepare for the solemnity of the court. So I do think that is important. And I would also say that
do visitors actually preparing to visit the court get any boost in solemnity from going through the plaza in the way you speak? They don't actually go through the front door, right?
They go through the two. You're correct, Your Honor. Since the entranceway was now the gold doors at the golden doors at the top of the second stairway, don't allow entrance. That is where visitors exit still. But the entrances, in fact, are now on the plaza level. They are on that terrace level, just a few steps up on each side, underneath,
or to the right,
underneath the main stairway, and that's where the metal detectors are. But to go back to also the display clause and to really envision it, Your Honor, of course, to have one demonstrator is to hear have many demonstrators. So it's not, you know, Mr. Hodge alone. It has to be considered in the aggregate. The Supreme Court in the Heffron case really demonstrated in that public fair context that you have to take into account the, you know, facial invalidation of a statute, not just applicable to a particular protester. I would also say that the public sidewalk, and the court made clear in Grace, it's a thoroughfare. There was nothing to distinguish that from the public sidewalks throughout the District of Columbia. And all of that combined reinforces the fact that the terrace, the 8 steps up, surrounded by this railway, is not a public forum. The history confirms that. There is no history of this area being open, this area of the court structure being open for general assembly and debate. And the case law does not find that courthouse steps in those areas are traditional public forum either. We cite those cases from several courts of appeals and lower courts on page 27 of our reply brief. And finally, I think the final reinforcement about the forum analysis here is Grace itself and the Cox case. Grace, the court did not decide the question other than for the perimeter sidewalk at the Supreme Court, but it did talk about how that area abutted up against a government property that has been dedicated to a use other than public expression. And that area they were talking about the sidewalk butting up to was the steps that go up to the plaza. Grace and Cox both...
You offered some distinctions in your brief for the press conferences that lawyers exiting the court give. And I have to say I wasn't terribly persuaded by your distinctions, which, to be honest, I now forget.
Your Honor, they're a very limited authorization by the Supreme Court itself, as binding precedent has recognized government property can be used for government purposes. It is immediately after argument, only immediately after argument. It is for those who participated in the arguments before the court. Those are officers of the court who are allowed to come down and speak to the press before they disperse at that point in time, for that very narrow action that is furthering the purposes of the court in getting that information out. It does not change the area into a designated public forum. That requires the intent to open it up for general access and speech, either to a class. This is a selected use by the court for, as I said, office of the court, members of the bar, for a very limited period of time immediately following court proceedings.
Can I ask you a question about the overbreadth part of the case?
Mm-hmm.
So for purposes of the overbreadth claim, are we supposed to take into account all the potential applications of the law, including the statute, including the fact that the statute applies in the building? Or, as I understand the way you've argued the case, you don't take issue with the notion that we considered an overbreadth challenge, but in some way as applied to the plaza alone?
Well, we certainly think taking into account the building would only bolster our argument significantly.
Right, but it doesn't seem like you focused on that. That
you're, isn't
you're,
the way.
You're willing to accept the notion that the relevant denominator is the plaza.
And I don't know if I'd be willing to accept that. I have to say we did not conceive it of in that way when you look at the scope of it. Certainly the idea of how it applies does perhaps change in the different circumstances even within the area that is covered. I think that there are differences even between the order and decorum within the courtroom chamber than out on the plaza. But I think that here, just even looking at this area, there is an ample wide breadth, including Mr. Hodge's activity, that is fairly and appropriately not permitted under the statute and demonstrates that it is not overbroad. And if I could just focus on the textual basis for our reading, the other side suggests that this is not rooted in the text, but when you look at the display clause, it's not a word that something's visible, it's displayed. That connotes some idea of showing something for view, and that is coupled by the other part of the provision that talks about something that has to be adapted or designed to bring public notice to it. That reinforces that it's not the just overly broad view that the district court gave to these words, but it means specifically a display, something that is put out there, brandished, or something, again, that is intended to bring attract attention or onlookers or a crowd.
Suppose the Sierra Club markets a T-shirt that calls for radical action on climate, and someone wears that in the plaza. How is that to be treated?
If that is simply visible as a person's attire, someone who's visiting the court, who's moving along, and there's nothing special to bring particular attention to that moment, that does not seem to be covered by the display clause. But if it is displayed in some way with some kind of ostentatious exhibit or to bring attention to it, displaying it to bring... Now, I'm not sure color would be adequate, Your Honor.
And it's an extra large.
If somebody is walking along. But if somebody turned around and started speaking in conjunction with it or drawing particular attention to it, that would be something that the display clause is aimed at. I just want to note on the assemblage clause also why I have just a moment here, although we don't believe that the court need reach that. That, too, has a more specific connotation than the district court gave it credit to. It talks about parade, stand, move, but not just that, in procession or assembly. Again, that has this connotation of purposeful exhibition to attract onlooker or a crowd.
Can we talk for just a second about whether the assemblage clause issue should be one that we should reach? So mm-hmm. This is based on evokes your argument on standing. And the critical paragraph in the complaint is 29. And there is this part where the plaintiff says that he desires to return to engage in various activities, either by himself or with a group of like-minded individuals. Now, I take it from your perspective, if it would have said and, or if it would have talked about like-minded individuals, that would have been enough. It's the fact that it says or that gives rise to the problem, because he might come back by himself, he might come back with others.
I think in the context of this case, without the speculative nature of like-minded individuals, without identifying like-minded to what, in fact, and the idea of, you know, not being any more specific of a group and what kind of action he would engage in, because the action here was this sole picketing, that we do think the court...
Okay, I'm not understanding the like-minded part, because suppose it just didn't even say group of like-minded at all. It just said group of individuals. If the allegation is just that I'd like to return to the plaza, and I'd like to engage in these activities with other individuals.
Well, that's not what it says. I guess his point is he needs to find like-minded individuals. He only wants to do it with like-minded individuals, and I'm not even sure who his like-minded individuals are. He hasn't really told us who they'd be.
Why does he have to? Like-minded only seems to support that it's going to be some sort of concerted action. I guess what I'm saying is he says he wants to come back with other individuals to engage in these actions. If that's all he said, mm-hmm. would that be enough for standing?
Certainly, Your Honor, it seems very thin and speculative, but I think that would be a closer case. And I do think that if the court addresses the assemblage clause here, that it too, the text supports this kind of interpretation that does not support the...
Yeah, I take your point on the merits, mm-hmm. But just in order for ourselves to determine what we're supposed to be addressing here. So put to aside that he focuses on either himself or other individuals for a moment. And then he also says what he'd like to do when he comes back is to make speeches. And I'm just wondering, if somebody comes and makes speeches and the target audience for the speeches is the general public, which is something that he says, both the court and the general public, does that itself implicate the assemblage clause?
If he were...
coming back by himself to give speeches, the natural intent of anyone giving a speech, especially if it's directed to the general public, I think, is to draw a crowd, as you rightly said mm-hmm. earlier. If you're going to give a speech and you're going to draw a crowd... my question is, does that necessarily implicate the assemblage clause?
The assemblage clause has been read to really go towards joint action. The words parade, stand, move are all coupled with the in possession or assemblage. So the lone individual may not necessarily be covered by that. It is a
even
circumstantial
if he's drawing a crowd,
determination.
It sounds like an assemblage to me. If
there is another provision of the statute, Your Honor, that forbids loud speeches. It's section 6134, I believe, and that may indeed be the provision that would apply. there. I wanted to mention one other interest that we talked about just very briefly. I wanted to make sure that decorum and order were really given their full throttled import, I think, because sometimes we pass over them too quickly. But there is also the interest in ensuring and avoiding that there is a misperception that the court can be influenced outside of the proceedings of the court. And this is very clearly unlike the legislative branch in the Rankin cases. The court there itself recognized. And it's the appearance between a public sidewalk that looks like all the other sidewalks in D.C. and this elevated marble enclosed railed stairway landing, you know, entry to the court is very different both visually and physically. And the plaintiffs suggest that that doesn't make a difference. But we would submit, Your Honor, it's actually the plaintiff who hasn't suggested that that makes a difference to his speech. The sidewalk is ample alternative channel of communication, a very deep sidewalk where there is a long tradition, history and tradition now of demonstrations that are not happen on the plaza. And when you look at that as that alternative avenue of communication, it is even more of a contrast to what would be the perception if it were on the plaza. Now, the protesters still get the Supreme Court behind them. They still have the image of that.
They're on the sidewalk.
But it doesn't carry the weight of the court inviting that speech as part onto its building structure or condoning even that as an appropriate way to be attempting to influence.
So can I ask a question about this perception part of it, which is the idea that, and I take the point that the government made the argument of grace and the court at least referenced the argument, and in your view with an eye towards crediting it. So this idea is that the court shouldn't be misperceived as affected by what's referred to as outside influences or external influences, like people who are holding up signs. Would that equally apply to individuals who write letters to the court? So somebody just says, you know, I'm not going to stand in front of the court and hold up a sign, but I really think you got it way wrong on this area of jurisprudence, so I'm writing letters. Could Congress pass a law that says individuals can't write letters to the court because it'll give rise to a misperception that the court is subject to outside influences?
It's a very interesting question. Two things I guess I would respond. First of all, just back to the premise, it's just not the court in Grace that recognized this. It was the Cox case also, the Jeanette Rankin, all realizing that the purpose of the decision making in the judicial branch is not open to that kind of influence, and it's for the integrity of the court to not give rise to that misperception, misjudgment. And many of the older cases in a different era talked about intimidation by crowds and in various, you know, about very significant socials intimidating. The question about the letter is interesting, Your Honor, because I think about situations where whether or not letters, for example, are allowed to be sent to jurors or to trial judges during trial. There is a concern, there are many concerns that arise. It arises ex parte contact with the court, in fact. The appropriate means for deciding issues that are before it are clearly before the pleadings, and extra record letters would be inappropriate, could be outlawed. On the other hand, letters to members of the judiciary that have nothing to do with pending matters, you know, would not raise that concern. So I don't think it's something the court has to decide here. I think that to the extent it dealt with issues that were before the court, there could be a significant interest that Congress could try and channel. And perhaps through some alternative means of communication to the clerk's office.
I guess, is there something different about letters and signs?
There's certainly something different about the public perception and the risk of creating a misperception in the everyday public that would think that, 50,000 people, protesters, now not being stopped at the bottom of the stairs. There's got to be a line somewhere. It can't be right at the door. So if the line is then somewhere on the plaza, is it viewed within that railing as if that is being
But we're only talking about one person, not 50,000, because we're not talking about assemblage. So we're talking about one person holding a sign.
Well, we're talking about one person combined by 50,000 people who might want to do it individually.
I see, discrete acts, unconcerted activity.
I think that where you plant one, a million grow on this particular area. I'd like to save the remainder of my time, Your Honor.
Well, I want to ask you some questions. And
certainly.
Just following up on the letter, I see a critical difference between a sign being held up in public and a letter that goes to a justice that, unless the justice publicizes it, or unless the sender says, I have a letter I sent and it didn't, wasn't returned to sender, so there's the appearance of influence. I think there's a huge difference.
Your Honor. I particularly think your second point is very good, because there's no indication that it was even received by the member of the court. It could have been stopped by the clerk's office.
Refreshed. Okay. Can I ask you to look at the statute, the wording of the statute, and also ask you to just assume nobody's ruled on it before.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I'd like to know if you think one person can stand in an assemblage, or can one person parade or move in a procession? I mean, an assemblage is an old term for assembly or group.
I think that that is best read to include more than one person in that part of the...
Okay.
Yes, the procession or the assemblage, because I don't think stands alone. I think it has to be read in connection with the procession or assemblages.
Well, I think it's intended to stand in a procession or a parade. I suppose you can, but you can certainly stand in
an assemblage. And I think if you're parading and you stopped, that too would be covered.
Okay.
But that might be an assemblage at that
point.
All
right. The main thing I want to ask you about, without regard to earlier interpretations of this statute, is I can't find, with the exception of Justice Stevens, who in dissent said that whatever the communication was not related to a party, organization, or movement. I don't know why everybody reads that out or ignores it, because if you look at what party, organization, or movement mean, you might think at first that party means individual. But when you look at organization or movement, I think it means political party. It means you cannot just display something, a device, a flag, or a banner that brings it public notice as gawkers, but it brings it public notice of a political party, organization, or movement. And nobody seems to read that last part of the statute.
I actually only have seen Justice Stevens's opinion also in Grace that addressed that. I think most of the cases actually, it goes without saying that it is encompassed within Mr. Hodges' actions here. You know, talk about movements. I think movement encompasses...
What he says is the U.S. government allows police to illegally murder and brutalize African Americans and Hispanic people. I don't see a political party there. I don't see an organization there.
No, I think there may
be a movement there.
I think it would be broad enough, perhaps the civil rights movement. I think that is a word of great breadth, and we do think that Mr. Hodges is indisputably covered by this. I would say...
Let's say he is, but the district court had all sorts of examples of school kids lined up to go into the court with T-shirts on and federal employees eating lunch and so forth. That doesn't conceivably come within the meaning of this statute.
We agree wholeheartedly. We don't believe that those are covered. We don't believe those are covered because they don't fall within the robust reading of the text of what display and public notice and all of this means. Those aren't...
Well, why are they First Amendment activities?
Exactly, Your Honor. I mean, they're not first... First of all, they're not expressive activities, so... Whether or not they would be forbidden by this, it wouldn't be a First Amendment problem, but we don't think that they would be because they don't have that expressive component. They're not, displaying something that's to bring into public notice one of these categories that you talked about, or standing or parading a procession or assemblage in a way to attract an onlooker or a crowd. The preschoolers aren't doing that. Employees at lunch aren't doing that. We don't believe those are covered.
And doesn't it make eminent good sense that what they wanted to stop was any sort of political statement or atmosphere in front of any courthouse, but certainly in front of the front steps of the United States Supreme Court?
And I would make two slight refinements that, Your Honor. We know from Grace, actually, in front of the courthouse is allowed if you're on the public sidewalk. So we would say, as part of the court structure, Cass Gilbert's, you know, architectural design here, that that is part of it. It is very distinct from the public sidewalk. I would say, I don't think, though, that the issues that you're talking about would have to be related to an issue before the court. I do think it's, I just wanted to make that clear from the way we have looked at this. But again, Mr. Hodge can engage in his speech, his expressive conduct with the Supreme Court as the backdrop. But what this provision reasonably does is directs him to that sidewalk instead of giving him the ability to be on the Supreme Court plaza, which serves different purposes and functions. Thank you.
I just want to ask one more question, just so, to make sure that we know it's in the case. So can I just get your explanation of why the 1507 isn't enough, the other statute?
1507 has an intent requirement,
yeah.
And so it really doesn't go, that is an intent to influence. It doesn't go at all to this question that we were just talking about, that where the intent isn't to influence necessarily specifically the Supreme Court, but it's perceived as such by the public, you know, right up at the courthouse door. And indeed, it would be very difficult to even know what somebody, the topic that somebody might be raising, whether or not it actually related to a case that was even.
It's the perception one that's the main axis of.
Yes, and also I think the order and decorum, Your Honor, there also is the local statute that prevents blocking of entrances and exits. But as I said before, order and decorum is more. It is more that you is reflected in the very visual and architectural design of this and the purpose of the building structure itself.
Can I just go back to one fact you said, and that is that for current ingress, you do go up onto the plaza, and then you go around under the stairs. So that in terms of that value, all these activities, if conducted on the stairs, the final set of stairs, would be less of a problem than if conducted on the plaza. Is that right?
At the time that visitors are entering the courthouse, but visitors are allowed, my understanding is, to exit
right,
and come
right.
down the grand stairway. So the timing would be a problem there. And indeed, the way the entrances are now, at the plaza, the terrace level, it continues into the terrace area that goes around the court, and there are just a couple steps up there that go into the side entrances, but they're almost like a funnel. It's even narrowing down, and it does raise more issues of crowd. Again, not if you think of many individuals or of the assemblage provision creating more and more issues there on the plaza and the order and decorum there.
Can I ask one more question? That is, there is an intent aspect in the display clause. A banner, flag, or device designed to bring into the public notice some political statement of some kind. I mean, I thought I heard you say the difference between this and the other was the intent.
It's a different intent. The intent under 1507 is an intent to influence the court. Here, it's really a purposeful conduct, I would say, in a way that, you know, that it's designed to do that. It's not this intent to influence the court or to intimidate the court, which is what 1507 is really directed at.
The intent is to keep the court separate from politics without respect to what case they're hearing or anything else.
That's right, Your Honor, with, and I have to emphasize here, with this ample alternative channel of communication, a very deep sidewalk that for decades now has been used for very robust demonstrations, just in the proximity with the availability of the court as a backdrop.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Light?
Good Morning, Your Honors. Jeffrey Light on behalf of the appellee, Harold Hodge. May it please the court. I'd like to begin by addressing the standing issue. The government's contention is that the assemblage clause at issue is not at issue here because the complaint does not specifically allege concrete enough plans. That is, it's too speculative. As the Supreme Court recently reaffirmed in Susan B. Anthony List, a challenge pre-enforcement to a criminal statute must look to whether the plaintiff has stated an intention or desire to engage in prohibited conduct. That is different than the certainly impending standard, which applies to future conduct. Here, Mr. Hodge has adequately stated that he is currently chilled and deterred from engaging in particular conduct. The question of whether the case should turn on or and, as Your Honor asked earlier, I think grammatically it might be a bit awkward to say he wanted to stand by himself and with others. And I would suggest that the federal court's jurisdiction should not be dependent on too fine a reading of parsing individual conjunctions or disjunctions in the complaint. The government repeatedly emphasizes that there is an ample alternative, that is, the sidewalk. But the statute as written does not carve out the sidewalk. And indeed, when...
Are you denying that the sidewalk has been carved out?
It has been carved out as to the display clause only by the Supreme Court in Grace. However, in construing the statute, the court needs to look at the entire forum, not a particular case, Grace, which was an as-applied challenge to the display clause.
That seems to contradict what you just I took you to acknowledge that Grace had removed the sidewalk as a scene for application of the display provision. But now you're shifting back to the proposition, which is correct, of course, technically, that it was an as-applied challenge as to that.
Because Grace was an as-applied challenge, perhaps I'm not being clear with the term carving out.
Clear, does it not, that the statute is void as applied to that area?
That's correct.
There's no doubt in anyone's mind on that.
It is void in the sense of it could not be applied, but as I point out in the brief, there's a distinction between partially invalidating a statute, that is, for example, severing a particular clause in it from an as-applied challenge. It couldn't be the case that a overbroad statute is saved from overbreath by plaintiffs engaging in a series of as-applied challenges, leaving at the remainder of an overbroad statute, something that is no longer overbroad. The court needs to look to the actual language of the statute in construing it.
Why is that? It's an interesting proposition, but why is it true?
There's no reason to think that Congress would have passed this statute knowing that it would have excluded the sidewalk. There's little...
How does that compare with the likelihood that they would back off completely because it was found invalid as to the sidewalk? That seems far greater jump.
There's no
terms of inferred intent.
There's no legislative history either way. It may have been that that Congress felt that if it was not possible to completely ban a certain type of activity from the entire forum, that is, to still allow it on the sidewalk, there really would be little purpose in banning it on the plaza a few steps away.
What about the building? The building's in the statute, too.
The building is in the statute as well, and Congress might have designed a different statute if it was just looking to the building. For example, passers-by wouldn't be seeing into the building. Congress might not have been concerned with the appearance that the general public has as to people that are inside the building. My point, though, is not that I can say definitively what Congress would have done or wouldn't have done, just that the question is up to Congress, not to this court, to determine what the how the statute should be written if it is if there is a carve out for the sidewalk.
You're in the odd position of arguing that Congress would have wanted the court to view the statute in the light most likely to lead to its being upheld, which seems counterintuitive.
It's really not clear what Congress wanted with respect to the sidewalk. What they did is they simply copied a statute that had existed for the Capitol. And when the Supreme Court moved to a new building, they applied it there as well. But as the three-judge panel noted in Jeanette Rankin Brigade, essentially the same language that was used as the Capitol was intended to create a sort of shroud of silence around the entire institution. And if that was not a possible thing to do because the sidewalk was going to be excluded, then Congress may or may not have passed it, but it really should be up to them to make a determination. The court should not be taking a statute and attributing an intent to it that clearly was not before Congress. The court should therefore broadly construe.
Every time the court narrowly construes a statute in order to save its constitutionality, it does exactly that.
And in this.
That's bad. That's automatically bad. I mean, I know it's subject to criticism, but it certainly has, as a doctrine, it hasn't been removed.
Well, this is a different situation because the Supreme Court didn't narrowly construe the statute. In fact, it very broadly construed the statute.
It did something different, a sort of selective invalidation.
And when the court does engage in selective invalidation, it needs to be very careful in making a determination in as to whether severance is appropriate or not. Here, there has not been such a determination, and the court should give the statute, therefore, its full and plain meaning in determining what is the forum at issue here and how broad the statute is.
Can I ask you a question? So, in Grace, the court references this objective that it should not, quote, appear to the public that the Supreme Court is subject to outside influence, or that picketing or marching, singly or in groups, is an acceptable or proper way of appealing to or influencing the Supreme Court, close quote. And I take it you don't take issue with the proposition that that's a legitimate objective for Congress to pursue.
It is a legitimate objective in the sense that there is certainly a legitimate importance to preserving the appearance of integrity. The question, though, is whether it is the means chosen are themselves legitimate. It would similarly be a legitimate objective to preserve the respect for the judiciary, but it would be a illegitimate means to do that by banning criticizing the court. And there's a series of cases in which the Supreme Court addressed this, talking about whether editorials in newspapers that criticize judges during ongoing cases can lead to contempt charges. And the Supreme Court in those cases reversed and pointed out that the dignity of the bench is not enhanced by enforcing silence. In fact, doing so does the opposite, and engenders resentment. This statute is, there is no reason to believe there were never any congressional findings, and there's nothing in the record to suggest that the statute as written actually would achieve its purpose, and it is
why doesn't it map on pretty tightly to that objective? Because what it does is, at least the display provision, it prevents the display of these sorts of signs and of the kinds of signs that your client displayed, and those sorts of signs could be seen as giving rise to an appearance to the public that the Supreme Court is subject to outside influence. Or that picketing and marching singly or in groups is an acceptable way of appealing to or influencing the court. Why doesn't it do that?
It is both vastly under-inclusive and over-inclusive. It is under-inclusive in that, as the government points out, there's some sort of intent requirement here. That is, somebody could be wearing a T-shirt that says Nike on the very same day that the Supreme Court has Nike before it, and perhaps people walking by would draw the inference that somebody's attempting to influence the court by doing that. Similarly, it is over-inclusive in that it prohibits any type of display, regardless of whether it has anything to do with the judicial decision-making function of the court. For example, somebody protesting, animal rights groups protesting, serving meat in the cafeteria, a group that is displaying their
So that degree of precision, to require that degree of precision in terms of under-inclusiveness and over-inclusiveness, suggests to me that you're assuming that there's some kind of strict scrutiny tailoring component applicable to this. And I take your point that if you think this is a traditional public forum or a designated public forum, then it gets you closer to that. But suppose, you, just for argument's purposes, that this is a non-public forum, that the plaza area is a non-public forum. If it's a non-public forum, then what's required is reasonableness. And we're not tasked with examining the law with that degree of scrutiny to determine whether it's over-inclusive or under-inclusive in those senses.
That's correct, but it still must be reasonable, and that reasonableness requires at least some legitimate nexus between the goal that the court is, that Congress is trying to achieve, and the language of the statute. And here, the connection is just so tenuous between a legitimate government interest and the language of the statute.
I don't understand what's tenuous about it, because if the objective is that we don't want to give rise to the perception that the court is subject to influence or appeal outside what the court described as the fair and orderly working of the judicial process, then why doesn't this at least seems to have a reasonable nexus to that objective?
There is no reasonable nexus to a legitimate government purpose. That is, the government wants to ban messages here because it does not like the effect that they have on the listener.
On the public perception.
On the public perception. It is a specific disagreement.
That would be a very serious problem if we were talking about a public forum. But if we're not,
the government's interest still needs to be a legitimate one. The government could not, for example, say, this is a non-public forum.
You're saying Justice White either got it completely wrong or was teasing us when he said, we do not discount the importance of this proffered purpose?
Sure. And let me give you an example. The government has an interest in preventing the appearance of corruption in government, but it could not say in a non-public forum, nobody here is allowed to talk about government corruption. The means that is used must itself be legitimate. What I understand the Supreme Court...
That certainly goes to a breadth issue, and I think I understand more or less your over-breadth claim.
Right, and in terms of the reasonableness of putting aside whether the whether it's a proper means to achieve it, in terms of the reasonable nexus, the problem here is that what the statute allows and doesn't allow have very little relation to what the public is going to perceive. There's no congressional finding on this topic as to whether the influence of people picketing or handing out leaflets would in fact cause that. There's nothing in the record that suggests it. When the government argued the case in Grace, and they put in their brief this very same argument, and that there would be a this parade of horribles, that if people were allowed to demonstrate on the sidewalk, that the court would no longer appear to be a body that is independent of politics. And in the decades...
You rely in your argument on overstating the claim. It's always easier to do that. The argument is basically that at the margin, preventing advocacy of this sort on the plaza diminishes the probability that people will perceive the court as responding to political contentions. So shoot that down.
Well, the government's interest is so de minimis in having somebody stand, allowing somebody to stand on the sidewalk compared to additionally allowing them to stand a couple steps away.
Despite writing for the majority, thought that it was a significant distinction.
The majority pointed out that there's little difference between standing on one side of the sidewalk and the other side of the sidewalk, and therefore a different side of the sidewalk was not an ample alternative, precisely because a passerby would draw little distinction between the two. Similarly,
what it said, there's nothing to indicate to the public that these sidewalks are any different from any other sidewalks.
That's one aspect of it, the notice to the potential violators. But towards the end of the opinion, it additionally points out that the public would perceive little difference between somebody who's standing on the perimeter sidewalk versus somebody standing across the street. And
I mean, these things always cut in multiple directions because, of course, it's equally true that from your perspective, what's the difference between being on the sidewalk and being on the plaza, which is the point that the government makes in its favor. So I think these arguments can be used in favor or in disservice of both sides' arguments. But it did seem like in Grace, the point that Justice White was making, as I understood it, was that, yes, we give credit to this interest in avoiding the public perception that the court is subject to appeal or influence through these channels outside the fair and orderly judicial process. And with respect to the public sidewalks itself, as Judge Williams was pointing out, we don't understand how that public interest is in fact vindicated because there's no difference between these sidewalks and other sidewalks. So the public is not going to have the misperception based on somebody being on this public sidewalk, which looks in substance and everything else indistinguishable from the other ones, that it's a means of influencing the court any differently from if anybody was standing on any other sidewalk. But when you get past the sidewalk, that principle just doesn't apply anymore. And so there is the possibility of public misperception that the court is subject to outside sway and that this is a proper channel for appealing to the court as opposed to the fair and orderly judicial process on which we typically rely.
That's the government speculation, but that is what the result would be. But there's nothing in the congressional history or in the record to suggest that there's any reason to believe that that would be the case, that there would be a difference. But I do, in candor, appreciate that it cuts both ways. The interest of being on the plaza is made somewhat less significant. Nevertheless, to the extent that the sidewalk is perceived as carving out a very small portion of the entire forum is not a sufficient ample alternative. A legislature could not say, here's an entire forum, we're giving you this one little spot to stand in, without there being a connection between why that particular spot is being given and the purpose. For example, that little spot is needed for ingress or egress. And so the rest of it needs to be preserved. But in terms of how things appear to the public, there is no particular difference between being on the sidewalk and being on the plaza. Indeed, somebody who is at home watching on TV might not even know where somebody is standing, whether they're on the sidewalk or the plaza.
In the amicus brief, there were pictures of people on the steps of courthouses, and they were invoked in support of the idea that the steps and the terrain in front of a courthouse was a public forum. Is it your contention that your client's rights go all the way up to the actual entrance level? Or do you draw a distinction between the steps and the plaza? Let's say the upper level of steps and the plaza.
One could dissect this forum into a number of different pieces. And the problem, and the reason we have overbreadth doctrine, is to avoid the situation where each individual step needs to be separately litigated, and in the interim, individuals don't know exactly where their rights stop. There is, for example, a case that the district court decided last year in which somebody was arrested not for displaying anything, as the government uses the term, but merely for what was written on a jacket that was inside the court building, but the court found that there was probable cause to arrest that individual. And obviously that's a different legal issue. I am pointing out, though, that in reality, those types of situations are going to be incredibly difficult to distinguish between somebody, whether somebody is displaying something on a shirt because they believe in the message or because they just, that just happened to be what was a clean shirt on that day. And the question of whether the intent was the intent of the designer of the shirt or the wearer of the shirt. These kinds of precise distinctions would need to be resolved on a case-by-case basis, and unless the court applies over breath, in the meantime, individuals are not going to have any idea as to exactly what they can do, and how exactly would one indicate to the Supreme Court police the reason why they're wearing a particular shirt so as to avoid arrest on a particular day.
What is, in, with respect to your overbreath claim, typically with overbreath analysis, what happens, as I understand it, is that somebody who, as to whom the statute can validly apply, be applied, brings a claim on behalf of other individuals asserting their rights on the theory that unless that type of action is permissible, there's too great a danger of a chilling effect such that those individuals will never bring an action. So we allow this in the First Amendment context. But typically what happens is there's some kind of distinction between the First Amendment claim or interest of the party against whom the law has been applied and those as to whom the law might be applied. What's the meaningful difference in this case between your client's First Amendment claim based on the activity that he engaged in and somebody else's First Amendment activity?
Well, I think overbreath serves two purposes. One is the sort of standing, relaxing of the standing to allow somebody to raise a claim of somebody who's not before the court. But another purpose of it is to avoid case-by-case piecemeal decisions when a statute does not have a substantial number of legitimate applications. In this case, it is that latter theory, that the problem would be in separately adjudicating each person's claim. I think that Justice Marshall points this out in his concurrence in Grace, what the problem would be there. Now, it might have made sense to separate the sidewalk and the plaza for the purposes of that specific case, but the way that where we are now is a claim about the entire forum, the plaza.
Well, whose claim would you like us to consider as part of the overbreath analysis? As part of the overbreath analysis that bolsters your allegation of facial overbreath? Because, as was suggested earlier, some of the individuals and some of the types of activities that have been bandied about in the briefing and in the district court's opinion don't seem like First Amendment activity. So it doesn't seem like those can be the basis of an argument that the statute is facially overbroad for purposes of a First Amendment claim, because we're not talking about somebody who's asserting a First Amendment interest in the first place. So what type of expressive activities on the plaza are different from the one that your client engaged in that you would like us to take cognizance of in assessing whether the statute is facially overbroad?
Some of the examples that were cited do not, in fact, involve First Amendment activity. For example, preschoolers,
right,
being assembled there, perhaps. However, I think that most of them do. For example, the animal rights activists protesting the menu, Supreme Court, or somebody having a labor dispute, those all would be First Amendment activity. But I think that the point that the district court was making was not necessarily that each of these examples would separately state a claim under which the law could be struck down, but to point out just what a poor fit there is between what is prohibited by the statute. That is, there are some things that are not First Amendment protected that are also prohibited by the statute. And those go to examples of how unreasonable the fit is. Because when the court looks at the reasonableness of the statute, it doesn't just look to the unreasonableness of one particular application. It needs to look at the unreasonableness of a total ban on a medium of expression in the virtually the entire forum, if the court excludes the sidewalk. This court pointed out, for example, in Initiative and Referendum Institute, that a total ban on soliciting signatures was not a reasonable means of achieving the interest asserted by the government in that case. The court did not say, for example, that a particular grouping or a particular scenario would be a reasonable application, and because there's one or a couple of reasonable applications, the statute is reasonable. It looked at the total ban, and that's what the court needs to do here as well, is to look at whether a total ban is reasonable, not whether particular situations would be reasonable.
Any more questions? Good. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Does Ms. Brinkman have any time? All right, why don't you take a couple minutes if you want.
I just to make two final points, Your Honors. This is far from a case that merits the strong medicine of striking down the facial, the statute is facially invalid. There are ample permissible applications, particularly if one considers the applications within the main building itself, but even apart from that, this is part of that building structure. We think there are ample permissible applications, including to Mr. Hodge. And on the reasonableness point, I think it's just bears noting that it's been 31 years since Grace, and there is a robust marketplace of ideas, demonstrations, and protests on this ample area in front of the Supreme Court. It is more than reasonable to direct Mr. Hodge to the public sidewalk there, where there he is able to reach the same audience and engage in the same expressive activity. And we submit that meets the more than reasonable standard for this type of provision.
In the context of this case, is there a genuine difference between testing for unreasonableness and testing for overbreadth? Particularly if Judge Srinivasan's question.
The reasonableness, I think, is Your Honor has written in cases, goes more to maybe the compatibility of the provision and the interests, whereas the overbreadth seems to go more to the permissible applications of it. And here, we don't see these impermissible applications on expressive activity that have been demonstrated, but some of the factors go to it as well. We certainly think that the ample alternative channels of communication, which is typically considered in the kind of public forum analysis, in some ways also influences the overbreadth. It's the sidewalk area here is part of the Supreme Court grounds. The statute makes clear that the grounds go to the curb. It's not a DC public sidewalk. It's part of the grounds. And that part has now been taken as the public forum, and that is part of the analysis we
have. Is the overbreadth claim, am I capturing it correctly, to say that the claim is that it's facially overbroad, the statute is facially overbroad as applied to the plaza?
Those are the hypotheticals that were posed and looked to by the district court, but as Your Honor pointed out, and as we point out to the district court, those weren't expressive activities.
I guess the point of it, seems odd to speak in terms of facial overbreath as applied to the plaza, because we're using facial and as applied in the same sentence, but it does seem like that's the way this case has been litigated, is the question is whether the statute is facially overbroad as applied to the plaza.
I think, in fact, it is the entire grounds, building and grounds, is what the statute and all of the provisions actually relate to, and it's also often, I think, overlooked that actually the sidewalk is part of that also. But I think in either event, the plaza or the entire enclave taken together, that we would survive a over-breath challenge. And if there are other issues, there's always an as-applied challenge available, but it certainly would not merit striking down the statute on space. Thank you, Your Honor.